All right, ready when you is.
I'm ready. Oh, hello, everyone. I'm Molly Wood.
I'm Colin Rizdahl. Welcome to Make Me Smart, where, come on, you know what I'm going to say. Tech, economy, culture, because none of us is. Oh, man.
I was like, what do you want me to do here? I'm not sure. I'm panicking.
None of us is as smart as all of us. Like Molly stepped on me, but fine, whatever. That's fine.
I did. I'm so sorry. I totally Paul Bunyan'd you.
Is that a word?
Today's episode of Make Me. You know what? It's because we did it differently at the top.
I'm just the talent, man. I do what the producers tell me to do. I am je ne suis pas responsable. Let me just say, I don't know where the French came from.
I don't look at you. Someone's been reading about Macron this week.
Yeah, well, that's too funny. Yeah.
Maybe that's why. Today's episode, ahem, is all about the problem with bigness. Bigness. It's a thing. It's in the title of a book. So now we know.
So it's real.
It's a familiar topic to you all. Companies getting too big, what that does to the economy and to society. Obviously, we have explored this a lot on Make Me Smart. We talked to Neil Irwin from the New York Times and we talked about the Amazon effect. But our guest today, Tim Wu, has a new book out looking at giant companies overall, including tech companies specifically, and how they compare to the Gilded Age, that time 100 or so years ago when monopolies dominated our economy to almost a religious extent. It was like an agreed upon philosophy of how to do business. Like, I didn't know, actually, until I was reading Tim Wu's book, a lot about the Gilded Age, this sort of period between 1870 and 1900, and about we've all heard the names Cornelius Vanderbilt and Andrew Carnegie and, John Morgan who built and Rockefeller and Standard Oil. And that's the time and those are the companies that the book is about and how they got so big and how Louis Brandeis became kind of the first and only voice against monopolies and essentially prodded Roosevelt, right, to break some of them up. I think Standard Oil was the first one after some intrepid reporting by a female journalist who pointed out all of the sort of very underhanded ways that it had achieved its monopoly. Tim Wu says we are headed back in that direction, which I should point out ended in the Great Depression. His new book is called The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age.
So the context here goes like this. Yes, Tim is right in a lot of ways. The companies are getting bigger and more powerful. However, you look at the most recent jobs report, 250,000 new jobs. Wages are up, unemployment's down or steady at like 3.7%, which is crazy low. So that's kind of where we started with Tim Wu, which is to say, what's the big deal?
Well, I think we have to look at the bigger picture as opposed to the last jobs report. If you look at any study of the last 40 years, you see that normal people, employees, have gotten a flat to diminishing share of the returns of this economy. And, you know, one or two good quarters shouldn't be the candy that makes us think this problem has gone away. The fact that wages have risen slightly over the last year doesn't make up for decades of stagnation. And that stagnation is directly linked to the ability of corporations as a bargaining unit not to need to offer anything more because they don't face much real competition. So that is the curse of bigness. I'll add to it, it's also a curse for the companies themselves, though they don't always realize it. This is the subtle part about it. It's true that at some point, companies can overgrow past their natural size at which they would be best for themselves. You know, they have the same problems that we humans have. They tend to get too big for themselves or overeat, in this case in revenue. So it can actually be a curse for themselves as well. So, you know, I think we have structural challenges, and I don't think we can let ourselves be bought off by one or two quarters of good results.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the Brandeisian philosophy about this, who coined the term, the curse of bigness. Is this book meant to be a bit of a manual for how we can address the dangers of concentration using, you know, actual antitrust law?
Yeah, it's sort of a call to recover our past and recover the solutions that we used in the earlier part of the 20th century and in the mid parts of the 20th century. Antitrust may not by itself be the kind of topic that makes people eager to jump out and start reading about it. And I want to make people sort of understand what the stakes are here for us, that what we're really talking about is who rules the country, how the wealth and income in this country is divided. And a lot of that has to do with the economic structure of our country. You know, I believe 100 years ago or so, we took a step that rejected monopoly. Frankly, the founding was also about rejection of monopoly, but a powerful repudiation of monopoly. But, you know, it's a forgetful country, and we've let things drift. It's true. We've let things drift and almost forgotten the legacy in this area.
I want to set the historical stage here for a minute, because you base part of your argument on, look, we've been here before in the Gilded Age, and now we're into the subtitle of your book, A New Gilded Age. Remind us what it was like 100-ish years ago.
Well, sure. So I think we have been here before. The economy of the early 20th century, the United States, was dominated by monopolies. There was essentially one monopoly for every industry. There was an oil monopoly, Standard Oil. There was a tobacco monopoly, a film monopoly, rubber. You know, everything had their own one company running it. And some people thought this was the greatest thing, you know, a step forward, a scientific advance over a competitive system, you know, Adam Smith, dustbin of history sort of thing. But I think the effects were pretty hard for the country. At least the regular citizens. You had the beginnings of a kind of income inequality that actually makes our time seem modest in comparison, and a real problem of government corruption by control of too much monopoly power. So that's what the situation I think we've drifted back to, and that's why I wrote this book.
Okay, but wait, and far be it for me to be a cynic here, but at least part of the solution to this is going to have to be legislative, right? I mean, you go to the Sherman Act, you go to the Clayton Act, and it was Congress doing things, and then a strong executive in Theodore Roosevelt specifically, but also Woodrow Wilson. And yes, I apologize, I was a history major. But look, in this country today, the Congress of the United States, and I'm pretty sure I've said this before, cannot find its backside with both hands, let alone agree on regulating the economy in a semi-controversial way. We have an executive at the moment who has his eyes focused somewhere completely otherwise. And also, oh, by the way, and this one is kind of on us, the people of this country, and you talk about this a little bit in the book, Tim, have become used to this being the way it is. And, oh, yeah, Facebook has all this power. That's fine. But I can still find out what's going on with my high school sweetheart.
Yeah. Well, I believe that big things have small beginnings. I will concede that we are very far down a path, which I believe we embarked on decades ago. But I think something is happening, that there is a movement, a demand for citizens, a popular anger at corporate size and power, a popular demand for what I believe is our tradition of breaking up too much power. And, you know, whether Congress doesn't do things, Congress reacts. Mm-hmm. The courts also react. And things have gotten so extreme, I think, so historically unprecedented, that the strength of the arguments is becoming stronger and stronger.
Well, so the strength of the argument's point, right? We had an economic cataclysm in this country 10 years ago, right? Came oh so close to the brink. And out of that came something called Occupy Wall Street. And it monopolized the national news conversation for a number of months. And yet, here we are now with banking deregulation happening and with no inclination that what happened in Occupy Wall Street and We Are the 99% has any resonance at all.
Well, one thing I think that happened, and I think this is an important lesson from the 20th century, is that a broad economic dissatisfaction tends to lead to the rise of extreme and populist leaders who, in his own way, Trump has obviously done this, seize that mandate and take it as their own, you know, promise bread for the workers, promise a war on elites. You know, Trump campaigning promised he'd take on big business, big pharma, you know, the things people care about, and deliver a return to greatness and prosperity. And so, in fact, the energy is there. It just is, in my view, channeled in the wrong direction, and frankly, in a very dangerous direction. I think one of the lessons of the 20th century is that America avoided a fascist or a socialist or anarchist revolution or seizure of power, partially in part because they broke up a lot of their industries and engaged in a lot of redistribution. The countries that didn't, Germany being a prominent example, Italy another, went in very dangerous directions. So I'm actually talking about something with, I think, incredibly large stakes. If we don't deal with this problem of concentrated private power, I think it will be dealt with in ways that we will find scary.
Yeah, I was very interested in your answer to Kai's question, because it does seem like although the regulation did not occur in the wake of the financial crisis, the anger did not go anywhere. And you point out that part of the reason President Roosevelt took on the trust and engaged in actual trust busting and breaking up of these big monopolies was because two reasons, right? That when popular sentiment is unmet, it leads to an embrace of autocracy or fascism, and also that it undermines the power of government. Like, is there a possibility that hope will come from pure self-interest, from government saying, huh, we don't have as much power? We talked to Neil Irwin about this from the New York Times, about government and central bankers saying, wow, we don't have as much power as Facebook or Google.
It could. And, you know, you could call it government. You could also call it we the people or democracy.
Right.
I mean, it could be you have a popular mandate to
what a concept.
More control. Yeah, I know. No, I think that there is. The problem is it has to be directed. One of the most dangerous things is sort of the false friend of this movement. So fascist leaders in the 30s, their method was always to promise that they were going to tame business and make it obey them and sort of humble them. But they had this, you know, more subtly, their interests were aligned. And the most terrifying thing about Germany and Italy, I think, was this union between private and public power, that the great leader would claim to be working on behalf of the people to subdue business and other elites and obviously evil forces and foreigners and immigrants and whoever else, but actually be in cooperation with big business. And that's something we really have to watch out for in the United States, is an extremist leadership which ends up in union with monopoly corporations across the board, leading a union of private and power. And I don't, you know, I'm not an alarmist by nature, but I think it is time to sound the alarm.
Well, and then what about, on the one hand, there is this movement. I think, you know, certainly you're seeing a tech lash. There is a sense that there's
Wait, what, a tech lash?
A tech lash,
okay.
A backlash right. against the tech
industry.
I've
never heard that before, but okay, yeah.
I just learned this from, I just learned this term from my guest, Mark Scott from Politico over in London, so maybe they're just saying it in the UK. But that is happening. There is this sense that, you know, maybe drug prices are a little out of control, which is one example that you give in the book. But what about, you could also argue that there are consumers who are starting to embrace business as a co-equal branch of government, who are starting to say, you know, the mission of it's okay if Domino's fills our potholes. Is there a danger of complacency?
I mean, I think absolutely. There is a question of what kind of republic we're in. And, mm-hmm. you know, I believe this was a republic founded for the human citizens. And I think that we are in grave danger in so many areas of sort of mixing up the lines between government, private citizens, and corporate identity. You know, part of it is what you're saying, is where you have corporations doing the role of government, public service. Now, you know, small parts I think are okay, but it can certainly get out of control. And we also have an era, I don't talk about this too much in the book, but where corporations have started to seize the rights of citizens, you know, the constitutional rights of free speech, mm-hmm. and almost everything except for voting rights, although maybe that's coming soon.
Well, wait, they didn't seize it. They were given it, right? The Supreme Court gave corporations the right of free speech.
They asked for it repeatedly.
After they lobbied heavily and spent a lot of money on that. Yeah.
And the Supreme Court of the United States said, sure, here you go.
That's true. Mm-hmm. I profoundly disagree with. But yeah. I think it's a symptom of I'm sounding like an alarmist again, but I think that much of my book is about the wisdom of Louis Brandeis, the jurist. And, you know, his vision was one where the citizens of the country really are the most important. And that anchors this idea that we need to be breaking big companies, big industries up. Because the more concentrated the industries, the more powerful corporations are, the more they squeeze out or don't leave room for human citizens, the more workers will never really get the pay raises they wish they had. Even, I think, sometimes executives get trapped. You know, we think, oh, the executives, well, they're the riding herd. Sometimes they're trapped in the structure as well, in some kind of, you know, structuralist way. They themselves are trapped working long hours, and it's all for this kind of inhuman creature, which has started to take over more of our and more of our republic. So that's what I'm warning about. Alien takeover.
Sorry, alien takeover.
No big deal. Alien takeover.
Yeah.
The book is called The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age. It's really interesting. It's very dense. Like, I can't, you know, I can't say that the book isn't a little bit dense and that it doesn't take some work to get through, but it is not very long. And it's interesting.
That's true. It is short. But you got to work for it. You got to work for it.
You got to work for it. Yeah. I encourage you to work for it. We're going to, in the fixation, talk about a potential counterpoint to the book that happened to come out today as we're recording this. But if you do, I'm going to in the fixation.
I have not been reading ahead.
Just I know. Spoiler alert. Okay. I was all over Wikipedia. All right. So I, you know, God, I fell off of the focus train. If you have questions for Tim Wu, however, after you read the book, if you read the book, please email them to us, makemesmart@marketplace.org. Our producer, Shara, has committed to sending some questions to Tim, and we will pass along his answers.
And Tim has committed to answering, more to the point, right?
Yes, I think that's the important part, really. Yep.
All right. Got to do some music and take a break, and then we'll be back.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
All right, we're back. Time for some fixes. At least we call the news fix. That's why I want the fixes. What do you want? You want to go first or you want me to go first?
You go first.
Okay.
You have thoughts.
I have thoughts. And my thought is, so we're recording this on Tuesday, the day the Amazon announcement came out. And lo and behold, Jeff Bezos has been jerking the national economy around. And yes,
what?
He is. Oh, please. Come on. I said this last week.
Oh, no, I agree.
Right? Mm-hmm. A little bit in New York, a little bit in D.C. Amazon's going to get bigger and he's going to get everything he wants and tax breaks and this and that. It comes right out of Tim Wu and companies of the size and scale of Amazon being able to do whatever they want. That's it. That's all I got.
Yeah.
I
promise that it will be a very brief story about Amazon, actually.
Oh, all right.
Which is that I have a friend who applied for a warehouse job during the holiday season and went to the training the other night. And it's in the Bay Area and the warehouse is in, you know, it's a warehouse district and not like the greatest neighborhood. Yeah. And these are overnight shifts or very late night shifts. And so everybody goes and they do this 4-hour orientation. And at the end of the 4 hours, the trainer says, okay, so, hey, I want to talk about parking before we go. We hire so many people that everybody has to park in this lot that's about a 15-minute walk from the warehouse. So here's a diagram of where the parking is and the, you know, and this, according to my friend, like this older woman raises her hand and is like, I'm working the 10 a.m. to 2 a.m. shift. Do you want me to walk 15 minutes in the middle of the night through this warehouse district? And also, by the way, I'm in my 60s. And I'm taking this sort of like $15 an hour. Yeah, about half of the people, including my friend, didn't come back. Like, just were like, all right, well, I quit.
Yeah.
But in case you're wondering, Amazon, with its $1 trillion valuation, declined to provide a shuttle for the safety of its holiday employees.
Yep.
Just throwing that out there.
Yep.
I have two related links. Oh, sort of stole that from the tech show, but these are related fixations, I promise.
Right.
One is I encourage you to read a Times article today, as we're recording this Tuesday, the 13th, about how and whether and when the Trump tax cuts may or may not pay for themselves. It's about, whether there has been a corresponding increase in CapEx and investment and wages and so on and so forth, and about how so far, although economic growth has accelerated, wage growth has not, nor has investment, which has been a little bit of a mixed bag, and companies are mostly buying back stock.
Right.
Which reminded me of episode 21 of Make Me Smart, where we looked at Kansas as use case for the ongoing theory of trickle-down economics. So I'm going to refer you to both of those links. As it happens, just today, also in the New York Times, there's a review of Alan Greenspan's and Adrian Woolridge's new book, Capitalism. Actually, it's from a couple weeks ago, from November 2nd.
Yeah.
Capitalism in America, A History, which appears, from the review at least, and I'm going to order it, to essentially be a counterpoint to Tim Wu's book.
Mm-hmm.
Were you jumping in?
I was going to say, you're really going to order this book? This is my job, reading this stuff, and I'm not going to order this book. But, you know.
Ooh, I'm just trying to get smart.
No, all right. I hear you.
From the review, in the author's approving view, men like the banker John Pierpont Morgan, the oil baron John D. Rockefeller, and steel magnate Andrew Carnegie, all born within a few years of one another in the 1830s, were, quote, giants of energy and ambition who exercised more power than anybody other than kings or generals had exercised before. I should note that they say that in an approving tone, and that their monopolies, that they also produce social and economic upheaval for many, is a small price to pay, the authors contend. I feel like if I read the one, I got to read the other.
All right. Fair enough. Well, yeah, so look, it's there are varying views on all kinds of history, economic and otherwise. And I think this is an interesting case in point.
I'll tell you what it says.
Yeah, you do that.
Okay.
All right.
Bye.
All right.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Once again, my favorite part of this entire thing every week is, I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about this. All right. So look, so Tim Wu's book that we talked about earlier picks up on some of the same themes as Neil Irwin's piece in The Times that we talked to Neil about a month, two ago, maybe, about the Amazon effect. So we're taking questions from you along those lines. First, Tom Hayes from Littleton, Colorado, left us this voice memo with maybe a new approach to organized labor.
I think a business case could be made to reform capitalism by using virtual unions, an open database containing all workers' types, along with the hourly wages those jobs pay. V-union members get free access to comparison data to help guide their pay negotiations, or they could learn where others get paid more for similar work and apply to work there.
I'm pretty sure that data's out there.
It mostly is. I mean, that's what Glassdoor does.
Yeah.
It's voluntary.
Yep.
Like the workers submit their, but it does sound like a case could be made for publicizing those tools a lot more.
Yeah.
Because yes, agreed.
Well, and that's the whole, you know, make everybody's paycheck public and publicize taxes and, you know, all that jazz, right? And transparency gets you to this place where everything is equal, except it really kind of doesn't. But anyway. Well, you know.
I don't know. Do we know?
Yeah, we do. Finland, actually, November the 1st is the day that Finland opens up its tax returns and everybody's tax returns are made public. And so you can see what everybody makes. And there, while Scandinavian countries probably operate in a much narrower equality or inequality band than, say, this country does, there's still gaps in, you know, equality because that's the way capitalism works. But anyway.
That's fascinating. Yeah. I did not know that.
Yeah, you totally can.
Thanks, Kai.
Anytime.
You made me smart.
There.
Claire.
And that's even without reading that Greenspan book.
Right? So. He didn't even have to look it up on Wikipedia. He just knew that. Claire Holdinghouse Ireland wrote to us about how the Amazon effect of companies getting bigger depends a bit on where you live. She's a lifelong resident of St. Louis and sent us this.
We and others here in the Midwest have watched a lot of our businesses be consolidated away in recent decades. And while I believe that labor market consolidation is ultimately bad for everyone, regardless of geography, my sense is that some parts of the country, mostly coastal cities, may have actually benefited from consolidation in some ways, at least in the short term, as job opportunities were shifted to those areas and as wealth flowed coastward.
Yeah, totally. All you have to do is look at Long Island City, New York today, the day that Amazon makes its announcement, and the completely made-up town, by the way, of National Landing, Washington, D.C., which is not a real town. It's Crystal City. And the 25,000 jobs that they're going to get to pay $100,000 or more. Now, while I love those two cities, they don't actually need 25,000 people making $100,000 a year or more. They don't. Ottumwa, Iowa probably does. Right. Kansas City, Missouri probably does. Amarillo, Texas probably does. Not Manhattan and New York.
And people might have moved to those towns because they could afford houses there. Whereas in Crystal City and Long Island City, prices are already going up.
Right.
Real estate prices are already going up and have been on essentially strength of a rumor.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep.
So there we go. All right. What else we got? Carrie Arnold. She's a small business owner. She feels the Amazon effect on her lighting stores here in California. Her customers say they basically want her to operate like Amazon Prime. Man, which I bet it makes her crazy. Here's I don't even know what this is going to say yet. Here we go.
If we were to two-day ship all of our customers' orders, we'd be out of business.
Yeah, that's right.
Even though we have freight agreements that help mitigate sizable freight costs with our most used suppliers and order from them on a frequent basis. I feel that most folks don't understand and frankly don't care about how expensive it is to run an independent brick-and-mortar business.
I think that is probably true.
She should come on Marketplace. This is what, have you seen that commercial? See, I've been watching a lot of live sports lately because, you know, it was like playoff season. Amazon.
Wait, what's baseball?
Baseball.
All right, just check.
And then, of course, well, it was simultaneous, actually, because it was baseball, but then also the NBA season came back, and I was like, I'm watching every game. I care about every team for like 3 weeks.
Oh, my God. Where did that voice come from?
I really don't know. Some sort of like...
And your little dog, too.
Some sort of like basketball Muppet situation. I don't really... I'm not proud of that at all.
But we got it on
anyway,
tape.
This is where Amazon would say, oh, I have an answer for you, Carrie. You should just sell your goods on Amazon as a third-party seller, and we'll handle all those logistics for you. And they were running these ads that said that, like, as long if you use Amazon to sell your stuff, then your business is open 24 hours a day, except that Amazon will use all the data about your best-selling products to make its own version of that product. And I'm just saying, time for me to stop talking and do the Make Me Smart question. That question, of course... What is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? Steve Van Kuteren from Lehigh Valley, Pennsylvania, sent us this answer.
Well, I thought that adults were responsible, that knew everything and always did the right thing. And of course, I was wrong about this. It really has had a profound impact to realize that adults, they're not smart, always smart and do the right thing. I think everybody has this same awakening at some point in their lives. It's a matter of what age it really hits you. For some, it's early. And for the more juvenile folks like me, it's a bit later. And it happens in stages. So anyway, that's it. Kai and Molly, keep up the good work. My best to both of you.
Steve, man. Whoa.
The good old milestone. You just keep waiting for the age where you know what you're doing. Yeah, it turns out.
It doesn't happen. Doesn't come.
It doesn't come. Wah, wah. But that's okay, because then you know that nobody else knows what they're doing either, and then no one can boss you around.
No. You always assume other people are more... Well, no, never mind. Never mind. Because that was just...
No.
That was going to be completely ridiculous, and anybody who knows me would have said, you freaking don't believe that, you idiot. What I was going to say was, oh, no, come on. You always assume other people are more competent than you.
Oh, yes. But thanks to some weird magazine article I read one time with Rob Lowe, no joke, taking his kid to college, you get weird things from weird locations. Anyway, it was this whole article about him taking his kid to college and his son saying, like, everybody here looks like they, you know, aren't even worried.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to his son, like, this great line, which was, never judge anyone's outsides by your insides.
Oh, that is a great line.
Isn't that a great line?
Oh, my God. Am I taking life advice from Rob Lowe? Wow.
I am, again, not proud, and yet I have repeated it to both myself and my child, like, many times. Like, just because they don't look nervous doesn't mean they're not. Just because they look like what they know what they're doing doesn't mean they're not crying in bed every night.
Absolutely.
The rest of us.
Full disclosure, I'm a fan of late-stage Rob Lowe. Young Rob Lowe, not so much. Late-stage Rob Lowe, yes. But anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, is that... I don't even know what that is. Is that...
Was that a dark place?
That was pretty good. I was like, wait, what? Oh, I recognize that. That's well done. That's well done.
I don't know which part is the dark place. I guess maybe just taking life advice from Rob
Late
Lowe.
Like, Rob Lowe? That's I don't know. Oh,
amazing.
My God.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
The sting has officially been deployed
and it is working in the
field.
So those of you who wanted to send it in, too bad. We got one. So look, keep sending us your answers to the Make Me Smart question. Once again, what is something you thought you knew but you found out you were wrong about? Email us, send us a voice memo, though. That'd be even better. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Ha!
Ha! You did it!
The Q says music starts after Kai says makemesmart.org. And I just thought I'd play around with the producer because they were messing around with us.
He got him with the same move that he hit me with at the top, which is if you pause strategically, idiot will start talking.
Well,
like me. It's like a prosecutor trick. Hey, Make Me Smart is excellently produced by Sharon Morris. The senior producer is Eve Tro. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Three adults who actually do know what's going on, in addition to our engineer, Drew Justad. This week, our theme music was composed by Ben Holliday and Daniel Ramirez.
And yet they put us in front of the microphones. Go figure that one out. The executive director of On Demand is Star Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. Oh, man, we ran out of music in a hurry.
Ooh.
Wow.
Wow.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.